Chapter 13. I'm not going to take any of this. Dr. Rick Bright hid for weeks in a friend's house in rural Virginia, alone but for the company of his partner of 15 years, his punishment for telling the truth in an age of lies. His Washington, D.C. address and phone number had been accidentally released by a major newspaper, rushing to break news of a whistleblower complaint he filed upon being fired from BARDA in late April 2020. Careful and private, Bright's life as a gay man had suddenly been spread and weaponized against him by top Trump officials, he believed. His phone had been overrun with death threats, graphic pornographic images, and general harassment since he'd risked his career to fight back against the Trump administration. People were walking by his house and launching eggs, but nothing lethal yet. He got armed guards to watch over. His adherence to science and reason had been manipulated to make the case that he was somehow a secret Democratic operative. To escape, he and a few confidants made plans to ditch his car somewhere between D.C. and his secret refuge, where he hopped into a friend's car and then transferred to another, to ensure no one could trace him to a vibrant compound with a gravel road, barking dogs, and roosters that woke with the sun. The scenery was peaceful, though it could not ease the anxiety he felt in the days before his life's defining moment, a nationally broadcast congressional hearing where he would outline the compounding and catastrophic failures of the Trump administration to prepare for and combat COVID-19. Bright's complaint described egregious and destructive efforts by HHS to downplay the pandemic, ignore warnings of mask shortages, and rush dangerous and unproven remedies to appease Americans' fear, including a plan to flood the streets with hydroxychloroquine sourced from suspect factories in Pakistan and India. It was known that the drug posed serious health risks to certain patients, including heart complications. Bright was reluctantly on board with authorizing the drug in certain controlled situations, with doctor supervision in hospitals for critically ill patients. But the White House and HHS leadership, desperate for a public relations win, wanted to rush the drug to pharmacies, where anyone could get the drug and take it without medical supervision. It was irresponsible and dangerous. So Bright leaked information and emails to the media to warn Americans. Navarro, his once uneasy ally, stopped talking to him. In return, Asper Cadleck transferred him to a toothless role at the National Institutes of Health, which welcomed him with insults and suspicion. Cadleck had framed it as a promotion of sorts. But Bright knew that he had just been sidelined and silenced. When news broke of Bright's 89-page whistleblower complaint, fastidious and damning in its details, Mike Bowen, the mask guy, texted him. "Give 'em hell, Rick," Bowen wrote. There was no response. Bright had changed his number and gone into hiding. Bright took his ouster hard. The eldest son of seven children, raised by a single mother in the flat and dusty small town of Hutchinson, Kansas, Bright had long been fascinated by disease and the human capacity to mitigate it. The 1918 influenza, some researchers believe, began in Kansas and spread to the world as soldiers flew to the front lines of the Great War. The first COVID-19 death 100 years later also appears to have occurred in Kansas. Then, as now, the disease was allowed to spread freely due to politics and local leaders' desire to keep businesses open. For decades, Bright had dreamed of applying everything he knew from history and science to become the boy from Kansas who stopped a pandemic. As a reminder, he kept as his computer screensaver, in bold, the words, "Save the world." But access to his computer and emails had been revoked by the lead architects of the American failure to address the pandemic. DC has a way of crushing such idealism. He was now the man from Kansas who tried but failed to save the world. The night before the hearing, he and his soon-to-be husband returned to the city. They'd gone over and over what he intended to say. Just the facts. No emotion, no partisanship. As a coping mechanism, Bright told himself, "It's just 5 minutes. I just need to survive 5 minutes at a time," referring to the time allotted to each member of Congress, some of whom would be hostile toward him. He practiced living his life in 5 minute increments. Each 5 minute block represented his capacity to handle what awaited. He could do it, just 5 minutes at a time. The morning of May 14th, ahead of a hearing that promised to be devastating to his administration, Trump tweeted, "I don't know the so-called whistleblower Rick Bright, never met him or even heard of him, but to me, he is a disgruntled employee, not liked or respected by people I spoke to, and who, with his attitude, should no longer be working for our government." Bright's partner, Travis Elliott, a lawyer, told him to ignore the noise. "You got this," he said. The couple met up with Bright's high-profile whistleblower attorney, Deborah Katz, and the entourage entered together into the hearing called by Representative Anna Eshoo, a California Democrat. Bright, wearing a gray suit, red patterned tie, and an American flag pin, took the hot seat. Elliott sat behind him, taking notes. Katz sat at a safe distance to his right, out of frame, giving the sense to millions of viewers that Bright was alone. Before Eshoo called the hearing to order, Bright noticed that a couple of Republican congressmen on the right side of the room bumped fists, one of them saying audibly, "Don't worry, I got this." Bright had been through the ringer before and understood the theatrical nature of such hearings, where everyone had already made up their minds and came with some pre-planned grandstanding. After Eshoo called the hearing to order, the Republicans pulled the legislative equivalent of calling a timeout to ice the kicker just before a field goal attempt, lobbing several parliamentary inquiries to raise objections to the hearing without eating into their 5 minutes. The Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee, which is not an investigative committee, was not the venue, they argued to no avail. They hadn't been given all the materials, they claimed. Bright knew it was all an attempt to fluster him. To pass the time, he compulsively sipped at his water, which worried his attorney. Testimony is no fun when one must run to the toilet. Finally, after 30 minutes of preamble, Bright removed his mask to speak to a few socially distanced House members and a panicked nation. Just 5 minutes. "I am Dr. Rick Bright, a career public servant and a scientist who has spent 25 years of my career focused on addressing pandemic outbreaks. I have a bachelor's degree in biology and physical sciences and a PhD in immunology and molecular pathogenesis," he began. "Americans yearn to get back to work, to open their businesses, and to provide for their families. I get that," Bright continued. "However, what we do must be done carefully and with guidance from the best scientific minds. Our window of opportunity is closing. If we fail to improve our response now, based on science, I fear the pandemic will get worse and be prolonged. There will likely be a resurgence of COVID-19 this fall. It will be greatly compounded by the challenges of seasonal influenza. Without better planning, 2020 could be the darkest winter in modern history. And it would be. First and foremost, we need to be truthful with the American people. Americans deserve the truth." To a sparsely filled room, with most who were present wearing masks, he reiterated his warnings that the United States needed to increase domestic supply of masks and to develop a coherent national strategy for testing. "We had lost several precious months to inaction, laziness, and stupidity. But it wasn't too late to get back on track. We will either be remembered for what we did or for what we failed to do to address this crisis," he said as he closed his first 5 minutes. During her 5 minutes, Chairwoman Eshoo asked, "When you look at the first 4 months of this year, would you describe the government's and the administration's response as a success or a failure?" "We've known for quite some time that our stockpile was insufficient in having those critical personal protective equipment," Bright answered. "So once this virus began spreading and became known to be a threat, I did feel quite concerned that we didn't have those supplies, and I began pushing urgently in January, along with some industry colleagues as well. And those urges, those alarms, were not responded to with action. As the chairwoman passed to the ranking member of the opposing party, our pernicious tribalism was thinly veiled. Bright had questioned the sitting president and his men. Now he would be questioned. Texas Republican Representative Michael Burgess, a medical doctor, pointed out that BARDA had funded research into hydroxychloroquine, among other potential remedies. Just before his time expired, he suggested that BARDA had not done enough to investigate anecdotes from some doctors who said they had treated patients with the drug, which is not, in fact, scientific evidence. I'm hearing from a lot of doctors in my state, around the country, who have experience using hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, coupled with azithromycin and zinc, and they're reporting significant benefit if it is used early enough. His 5 minutes were up, but Bright answered, "I've heard those anecdotal stories as well, and they were not conducted in the context of a randomized, controlled clinical study." The hearing would continue in this way for nearly 4 hours, going back and forth from Democrat to Republican, friendlies to adversaries, giving either side of a divided nation what they wanted to hear, 5 minutes at a time. Something as simple as a documented chronology of events could not escape the politics of blame and accountability. Finally, Bright was dismissed. He stood and walked to the back of the room, looked back and nodded to Eshoo, who gave him a salute. He turned toward the door, brushing past a balding, silver-haired friend whom he had never formally met, Mike Bowen, who was up next. Bowen is not of D.C. He had been summoned to provide context for dozens of emails Bright included in the whistleblower complaint, of his partnership with Bright and Navarro, and years of warnings to the federal government. Though he was honored to appear before Congress, his respect for the decorum of such pageantry was thin. He was tired and frustrated, and he'd brought a little bit of Texas with him. "I can confirm that the emails in Dr. Bright's complaint are mine," Bowen said in his opening remarks. "They are merely the latest of 13 years of emails I sent to BARDA in an effort to get HHS to understand that the U.S. mask supply was destined for failure. In my opinion, they didn't have enough authority. Their hearts were in the right places." The enormous mask machines Bowen had offered to the federal government in January were never fired up. While Bowen had talked directly to Peter Navarro, who told him the administration would move heaven and earth to get masks, the White House grew distant and eventually stopped responding. Instead, the federal government leaned into Project Airbridge and deals with companies like 3M, whose offshoring had put the nation in a bind in the first place. Bowen had concluded that Navarro was nutty. Navarro, in turn, would tell the press that Bowen was difficult to work with. The truth, I would later find, was somewhere in the middle. It was a failure to communicate between two strong personalities. Navarro, pressing for immediate solutions in Trump time, wanted the brass tacks, a set amount of masks at a set price, even an obscene price. Bowen, on the other hand, wanted a long-term commitment from the government to buy masks off of new manufacturing lines. Frankly, both could have happened, and it probably would have saved lives. In emails, they talked past each other. Bowen's proposal was convoluted and lacked the bluster of other pitches that had won multi-million-dollar contracts, such as Robert Stewart's or VPL Medical's, neither of which had a factory or expertise in manufacturing masks. Bowen could have delivered. He didn't have any lobbying experience or know how to navigate the mechanics of government purchasing. Navarro, firmly in control of government contracts in early 2020, could have directed tens of millions of dollars to Prestige Ameritech and procured millions of masks for less than a dollar apiece. A major victory for both the company and the nation. As the federal government expert saga told us, had Bowen simply said he could deliver 6 million masks at $6 apiece, he almost certainly would have been given a no-bid contract and many millions to do so. He could have made a fortune. Bowen would also harbor suspicions that Navarro didn't want to give Prestige Ameritech a major contract because he was not a fan of Trump and had been quoted saying as much in the press. Instead, the company was thrown a bone. A $10 million deal with FEMA to deliver batches of masks over more than a year. At less than a dollar a mask, it was a far better deal for taxpayers than the dozens of mask contracts I'd chased down. That small contract was enough to blunt the bad press of having passed on an offer for masks in the first weeks of the pandemic, but not enough to make a dent in the stockpile. It was also a small piece of the company's business, most of which was with hospitals that made long-term commitments to avoid the Wild West mask market. As members of Congress inquired further into his business and his relationship with Bright, Bowen's penchant for plain-spoken defiance began to slip through. He was irritated that his friend Bright was being maligned. It seemed that everybody who was beating up on Dr. Bright was a Republican, and everyone who was defending him was a Democrat. I'm a Republican. I voted for President Trump, and I... He took a moment to consider what he would say next. I admire Dr. Bright. I don't know what he did in all of his other activities, but I think everything I've heard, and every time I've talked to him, and everything he said here, made a lot of sense. And I believe him. Despite his many years of prodding the country to prepare for this exact scenario, Bowen's insistence that the government invest in manufacturing lines and labor, instead of orders that might disappear, was used against him. In his line of questioning, Representative Brett Guthrie, a Republican from Kentucky, implied that Bowen had not done enough. I know that the president has asked General Motors and Ford to make ventilators, Guthrie said. And everybody's business is their business, and they make decisions based on what's right for their business. But during a pandemic, there is an upload. And if every business person says we're not going to adjust our lines during a pandemic... Bowen stared daggers at the congressman. The nuance had been ignored. Prestige Ameritech had ramped up its production of masks, with his business partner parking an RV outside the warehouse to keep the N95 lines running 24/7. They had built new machines to get more out to market. The workers were dog-tired. But it was those four machines they had sitting idle, and which needed significant investment, that was getting the attention. Guthrie offered some equivocation. And I understand, Guthrie continued, that Ford and GM have different access to capital than some others. He trailed off. It's just something that everybody needs to be concerned about, because in a pandemic, you do have increased orders, but I understand you want some long-term guarantees as well. But there are a lot of people making decisions. Nowhere in that ramble was there a question. Bowen had just been accused on national television of being unpatriotic. He was furious. Guthrie brought his comments back to a technical question about the company's masks. Bowen answered. Next, he questioned why Bowen was dealing with Bright and not trying to sell masks to the Strategic National Stockpile, whose officials had for years ignored Bowen. You got it all wrong, Bowen said, now agitated. I wasn't looking for business. I don't need your business. My phones are ringing off the wall. I thought of BARDA. I thought of them as brothers in arms. I knew they couldn't buy my products. I knew that. But they were the only people who believed it. On defense, Bowen listed off everyone he'd warned over more than a decade. Trump, Obama, BARDA, the NIH, CDC, the stockpile, hospitals, the media, Congress. My conscience is clean, Mr. Guthrie, Bowen said, staring down a member of Congress. I've been working on this damn issue for 13 years trying to save lives. Nobody listened. And now? He took a breath. I'm not going to take any of this, what you're trying to do. Guthrie talked a bit more, apologized to Bowen, and yielded to Chairwoman Eshoo. I think my colleagues will agree that my description of Mr. Bowen is that he is a force of nature, the chairwoman quipped. As members of Congress quibbled with the men who tried to warn us, The real force of nature was ripping through communities, killing without regard for political preference. As of that day, the United States had confirmed more than 1.4 million infections. More than 85,000 Americans were dead.